And the finite level has no more contact with the absolute level than does the first floor with the third floor there. They don't touch at any point. You don't just don't register. So this requires the projection of an intermediate level, the absonite level. In these papers, the absonite level is defined as a pre-echo of the finite level. In other words, it's just as logical to think of it as coming after as it is before. The absonite level is not timeless. It transcends time. A timeless being has no time consciousness. Best illustration I can think of is Jesus' thought adjuster, who's timeless. And he warned the master. He said, now look, you don't want to get involved in any abrogation of natural law. Now, as concerns space, I'm in perfect command of the situation. If you idly wish you're in Rome, it won't happen. I'm space conscious. Adjuster would have to be, otherwise how would he find us? But he said, I'm not time conscious. Time to me has absolutely no meaning. So if you want to do something which merely involves the shortening of time, I can't help you. I don't work on that wavelength. A thought adjuster, in terms of time relationships, is up on the third floor. Now, a transcendentaler, an absonite being, like an architect of the master universe or a force organizer, they know all about time and space. They're perfectly conscious of time and space and transcend time and space. They're not timeless. They're not spaceless. They are time transcenders. They are space transcenders. When we go to paradise, we're going to find the Father. We're going to be working at the bottom of the finite level. We're going to get into the center pole, and this is the universal Father. It's a genuine, legitimate finding of the Father on the most limited basis possible. It is the minimum finding of the universal Father. As finaliters, we go out and successively serve in super universes other than our Bantan. And each time we come back to paradise, we find the same universal Father, but we're up a little bit on the center pole. You know, it's a long ways between the floor and the ceiling of the finite level. And believe me, the finaliters are not at the ceiling, although they're a decent ways up. When we want to see what is total deity on the finite level, well, what we're asking to see is, how does the Trinity personify on the finite level? We want to meet Mr. Trinity. There is no Mr. Trinity. The Trinity is a corporation. You don't meet a corporation. It's a legal person, but not a person. We'll be shown the seventh master spirit. This is the nearest thing we can, this is the infinite spirits concept of what the Father, Son, and Spirit would be like if they were alike. That's fine. But someday, if we can find the Supreme Being, then they can say to us, this is the Paradise Trinity, as the Paradise Trinity is comprehensible to finite creatures. But we'll have to reach the ceiling of the first floor to do that, because that's the age of light and life, the ceiling of the first floor. The Supreme Being will mean to us then, in our effort to understand total deity, that's what we're studying here, the function of total deity, just what the personality of Jesus means to us right here and now in our effort to comprehend personal deity. I don't understand the Universal Father. I don't understand the divinity of Jesus. but I jolly well do understand the humanity of Jesus. I understand the Son of Man. I'm intrigued with the Son of God. But they're the same person, and that helps me live with my failure to understand his divinity. I do understand one pole of him. The other pole is still shrouded in some mystery. But I know it's the same person. I know I like him. I know I'm going to like his divinity, because I do like his humanity. The Supreme Being is going to do something else for us. He's going to help us break through into the second floor. Incidentally, there's where we'll start in equipping all that roughed out plumbing, you know. We have capacity to do this. The papers tell us this. The Supreme Being will help us break out of the finite level, just as Jesus helps us break out of the material level. He's a living bridge. Like God, he's no respecter of persons. Only, he works with totals, because he's a total deity. The Father deals with each of us as individuals. The Supreme Being will not deal with any of us until he can deal with all of us. The Father emphasizes the each relationship. The Supreme Being emphasizes the all relationship. You believe, the Father welcomes you into the family. Jesus' story of the prodigal son well illustrates the attitude of the Universal Father, where love is paramount. But this isn't enough for the Supreme Being. You've got to produce. He needs us. Therefore, he awards those of us who are productive. You can get rank with the Universal Father, but you can get campaign ribbons with battle stars only from the Supreme Being. And this means you have to be there and do something. Now, we're going to consider the second universe age, the third universe age, because the minute we deal with the seventh level of the function of total deity, we've got to break out of the present age. We've got to consider the widespreading areas of the outer space levels, because up there, a second experiential deity is in process of growth, just as the Supreme Being is growing in the present age. There are four outer space levels. Last year we worked out, we did some arithmetic. Now let's just take it for granted this year. I've got it in writing in Julius.
We have a box, if you like one.
Yeah. But again, we based our arithmetic on clues given in the papers. And we had to make some assumptions, and wherever we needed to, where there were two possible assumptions, we chose the more conservative of the two. And here are the rough magnitudes we worked out. This whole book is mostly about the seven super universes in Havona, right? And we said, let's get some sizes to think about. If we think of the seven super universes in Havona as being roughly like a tennis ball, what would that be in relationship to the first outer space level? Well, it adds up to a very small bedroom or a very large closet. Think of a room which is 8 cubic feet, 8 by 8 by 8. But what's this room?
19 by 22.
19 by 22. So if we figured about a third of this room, it wouldn't be too bad, would it? In other words, if I got up and stood about here, this wouldn't be too far off from 8 cubic feet, would it? Sound reasonable? Can you see a tennis ball hanging in the middle? It's pretty small in relation to the room, isn't it? That's the first outer space level. Now, to visualize that in relation to the second outer space level, we should get a city block, visualize a city block with 8 building sites on it. These are generous lots, 100 feet. Get your block squared up, same on all sides, it's a square block, and then go up 800 feet. Put our small room in the middle of that city block. We've got it, that's the second other space level. I picked cubic Chicago from a third outer space level. I want a 16-mile cube.
Tell me, please, why are you, did I miss this? Why are you picking 8 all along the line?
It just works out that way, conveniently. The math we work, we computed this in light years.
And this is your premise, this is the original premise.
Yes, we did our computation in light years, but because they give us light years in here. They give us something to figure out. But the numbers leave you cold. When I can get it into tennis balls and rooms and blocks, you can feel them.
Very visual, yes.
I picked cubic Chicago because I want something about 16 miles cubic. Toss the city block in the cubic city. You get the third outer space level. And for the fourth outer space level, I picked the moon, even though it's somewhat undersized. I'm about 30% shy in my volume in the moon. This book is written about the tennis ball. When we move from the first floor to the second floor, we've now got to think in terms of the magnitude of the moon. This is too big. All you can do is feel it. But we are going out there. So they tell us. This is what we're in training for. Now look, when God really pervades a human life, you get a flavor such as you find in the life of Jesus. If that seems too tough to look at, consider the impact which Jesus had on the lives of the 12 apostles. And you can see what even a secondary impact does. We're talking about spiritual growth now. You know the long story of the ascent to paradise. You know that it's tough. It's not easy. You're not a milk toaster when you get up there. What is it long since you've learned to feast upon uncertainty, to fatten on disappointment, to show indomitable courage when confronted by immensities? Long since your battle cry has become, in liaison with God, nothing, absolutely nothing is impossible. These are tough, salty veterans as well as sweet people. Consider the training a Phenolator gets. Consider the tremendous training that lies ahead for the Phenolators, because these 7 super universes are going to be around for a long time and they're still growing. Gee whiz, our local universe isn't anywhere near settled in light and life. Michael's only got life planted on about 1/3 of the projected worlds. This universe is 2/3 unstarted. We haven't even got the subdivisions opened up yet, much less the sewage yet. This is still inside the tennis ball. What's a 7th stage finality going to be like? As they say, they think that when we enter the 7th stage of spirit existence, this will be the last of the jubilees of time and will inaugurate the first of the jubilees of eternity. What are finalities going to be like in the fourth outer space level? Have you any way, even faintly, to grasp at the time involved, fellow Bantus? We are up against 1, 2, 3, and now we've hit many. And 1, 2, 3 represents our limit of time comprehension. This is many. Many, many. We're going out there. This whole development involves uncoupling 3 new levels of human personality. We're told that we have 7 dimensions of personality expression. And I think Bud made a pretty good explanation of that when he said it's like building a house. And you know you're going to grow, and you only want to pour these foundations once. You're going to provide for 7 bathrooms, but you're only going to have use for 3 of them, which are the 3 we're using now. So what do? You rough in the plumbing for the other 4. And now we're going to start equipping 3 out of these 4 to operate. These have been lying here dormant all this time. Now we're going to open up a new annex, a new wing. Yes?
Pardon me, please. I have a question here about this absinthe that I wrote quite some time ago when I first read it. Is that our mortal goal I've written to reach absinthe levels of super creature attainment? Is that our mortal limitation?
That's our post-universe age goal. We can't do it in this age. We can fumble with it. We can fumble with it. Here's what we'll encounter. We're told that differences of attitude, feeling, and response persist forever. For example, males and females are still going to exhibit characteristic non-sexual qualities of maleness and femaleness in the core of the finality. We'll intrigue each other. We'll think a little different, thank heaven. What was it the Frenchman says, vive la difference? Intellectually, we even off at the end of the Marantxa career. That is to say, we have equivalent horsepower of brains, mind. This doesn't mean that the artist will be adept as a physicist. We'll still have our specialties, you know? We'll still be highly individualized, but we'll have equal basic brain power. We will encounter spiritual differentials. These won't even out until we enter the core of the finality. Then we will have equal spiritual capacities, responsiveness, or quality. And when we even out spiritually, then we discover a new differential, absinthe differential. We become conscious of this. So we're working at it. I think at the upper limits of the first floor, we begin to get repercussions from the second floor, even though we aren't there yet. You know, you get to Uversa, who do you find there? Havona Servital's down there working. They're getting you ready for Havona. You aren't at the Havona level yet, but you're dealing with Havoners up on the Super Universe Capitol. There's an overlap there. The word absinthe is used in this sense. The architects of the Master Universe are referred to as having wonderful minds, superb spirits, and supernal absinthes. This is a quality of being, analogous to mind and spirit. We know nothing about this. The word absinthe is a word which is used as an adjective to designate the second floor of the firehouse.
See, it utilizes part of absolute.
It seems to be a mix, yeah. It's a coined word. Yeah.
I just noticed that. It's very obvious, but.
They also use the word transcendental to apply to the second floor and speak of absinthiters or transcendentalers as living on that floor. That's a good word. They transcend time and space. They define the attributes of deity as they appear on the second floor are omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience. These are not absolute attributes of deity. They are ultimate attributes of deity. The Supreme Being, for example, is not omnipresent. He is ubiquitous, which means many presences, but not omnipresent. He's not limited to one presence, but he's not everywhere. The Infinite Spirit, through his creative daughters, is ubiquitous in the 7 super universes. Each local universe mother spirit pervades her local universe and nowhere else. See, she's a space conscious being. And if she weren't space conscious, she wouldn't know where to stop being, and you'd get conflict between 2 local universes. She where she is, that is Nebadah. And when you go outside of her, you've gone outside of Nebadah. Now, when you get up to the absolute level, you have presence, which is beyond omnipresence. This is a presence quite apart from space. On this absonite level, I like that word, it's handy, sharp. We're going adventuring. We're being commissioned to work out on these outer space levels. Why? All right. Why do the counselors come down? The Paradise Sons come down. Come out, I should say, into time and space to work with us. We need them. We're imperfect. We need a lot of help from beings who have more of perfection, even much of perfection. They've got to be a ladder that we've got to climb. How could you explain God except by living him as Jesus did? I mean, you look at his life, and the papers are right. His life is greater than his teachings. That's the same reason we're going out there. They need us. Why do they need us? They're being deprived of something. Well, what is it? The Supreme Being has finished his growth. And the kind of growth that we know about will then be a permanently past event in all creation. We can grow as we grow because we are plugged into the Supreme Being. We share in his growth. This whole experiential evolutionary process requires the growing presence of the Supreme Being. And when he's finished his growth, it's over. No beings will ever again grow as we are growing today. These beings out in outer space will benefit from his presence. We suffer from his absence. They'll benefit from his presence, but they can't have his presence and also participate in his growth. We've hit another inevitability here, haven't we? You can't make square circles. You can't be a part of something incomplete and enjoy it as a completion. They are going to be lacking the very thing which we are, which is experiential, evolutionary beings. It's up to us to compensate them for this deprivation. Just as the beings of the central creation try to atone to us what we lack because we are starting in imperfection. We've got a mission out there.
Are we not perfect as far as we go?
Hmm?
You say we are imperfect. I think perhaps I put it not too small a scale. I think that human beings are rather perfect. I don't mean spiritually, but
no.
Physically, materially, I think we're rather perfect.
We exhibit the fact that the design was done by superhuman technicians. Those are life carriers that designed this. They drew the blueprints.
Well, then in this we are perfection.
Yes. Well, we're not perfection. The body does wear out and die. But it's a wonderful piece of equipment.
It's suitable to our...
We're suitable to our... We're well adjusted to our environment.
Adapt perfectly. The design, perhaps, is perfectly suitable to our evolutionary...
Relatively suitable. Relatively suitable. We fit, is a good word. We stand at the apex of planetary evolution. But that's on the bottom rung of cosmic evolution. It's the difference between being a graduate student and a freshman. And the two are very close together. The peak in one area is the beginning of another. Yeah, I get your point. From the standpoint of this world, we look pretty good. From the standpoint of the next, we're just beginning. We're larval.
Yeah, but there is a certain perfection that larva can fulfill.
Which is to graduate.
Feeble tadpoles.
That's right. We're tadpoles. We're well-adjusted tadpoles, and we'll be frogs someday.
Another perfect is a tadpole.
Bill,
yes?
Our new worlds that are being made are 606, and the new ones that are coming up, will the life carriers improve on our type?
Why, sure, they have already. They so state.
Oh, they do.
They work out a better technique for healing injured tissue.
Oh, that's right.
Greater relief from pain and greater control over proliferating cells, which suggests to me less cancer. Our goal out there is to go in quest of the Father all over again. You see, if we can go through this tremendously long period of growth, going from the tennis ball to the moon, I can't grasp that. I can say it, but it doesn't really mean anything to me, except I can feel that I'm trying to cope with something that is, I'm a Bantu trying to visualize 1,000. And beyond 3, I've got the word many, that's all. In fact, I'm worse off. I think I'm trying to visualize 1,000,000,000,000 as a Bantu. We're in quest of the Father. We're in quest of God the Ultimate, who is on the second floor what God the Supreme is on the first floor. And if we can ever graduate from the second floor, we're going to know God the Ultimate. And this is probably possible. This merely requires an unbelievably long stretch of time. We're told that we have 3 unexpressed dimensions of personality which can be expressed on the absonite level. So I think we've got the equipment to work up there. You see, when the Father gives us the thought adjuster and gives us personality, he's given us a tremendous lot of equipment. This is good for the whole race. This is good for the whole race. All during this time, we are exploring 2 ways. We are exploring the reality of the Universal Father on superfinite levels. And at the same time, we are exploring the reality of this thought adjuster within us. Example, they tell us when we fuse with our thought adjuster that one of the things which the adjuster contributes to the combined nature of the fused being is past eternal memory. But I don't think we can cope. I think we have to live forward long enough to be able to think equally far backward. So that if we live 1,000,000 years forward, I think then we can cope with what the thought adjuster is trying to give us. We can think 1,000,000 years backward. And if it's 10,000,000,000,000 years, then we can go that much farther backward. And someday we will look back on units of 10,000,000,000,000 years and understand what they mean. They will then become as days are today in our planning. And we can each know the truth of this because we feel it in our own lives. A week is not a long time to an adult. A week is a very long time to a little child. A summer vacation is a small slice of eternity. And yet, is 3 months very long? No. 3 months is a very short time. We can see this beginning in our lives now. And this is going on and on. We are not going to, I don't think, ever really lose our sense of time. But when you can deal with 10,000,000,000,000 years as a unit and build it in terms of a program involving other tens of trillions of years, you have worked into a new relationship to time, which is so quantitatively different from what we have now that it is qualitatively different. Do you figure? This is the best way I can understand time transcendence. Someday, we will get to the end of the Epsonite road. And someday, the whole Master Universe will be finished. It'll be done. And God the Ultimate will be a finished being. And this will mean the complete function of deity on this 7th level. Well, is it all over then? No. It's not all over. because things can happen. Let's go back to the beginning now and consider what things were like just before the creative level was reached. At the beginning of all things, we have, in what I call the zero universe age, or just before the first universe age, we have two existential deities, right? The Father and the Son. And they have a power platform for operations, the Isle of Paradise. And what do? They produce a being equal to themselves, achieve the union of the Trinity, the first Trinity, and produce a universe which is limited as to quantity, but unlimited as to quality. I'm sure they could have filled all infinity with Havana, but they chose not to. They limited their creative act, didn't they, to 1 billion worlds. But they didn't limit it as to the quality of divinity expressed in that perfect creation. This creation is undilutedly divine, but it's not infinite. It's important that we realize something can be perfect without filling everything. You follow me? Now, Havana serves as a nucleus for the seven superuniverses, right? One of the characteristics of a nucleus is that it exists in relation to a cytoplasm, the white of the egg. To go back to eggs again. I love eggs. I love to use them as a
little. I love them. They repel me, but that's all right.
You only have to visualize them. You don't have to eat them. Havana characteristics are transmitted out here as beings come out here. And when this universe is finished, when the seven super universes are finished, I think we're going to have another nucleus, the second nucleus. The appearance of the first nucleus is associated with the appearance of the Paradise Trinity. The development of the second nucleus, which is the grand universe, meaning the seven super universes as dependent on the central universe. The appearance of this second nucleus is also associated with the formation of a trinity, the first experiential trinity. This is the trinity made up of the supreme being, the supreme creators, the architects of the master universe. I don't think that there will be any nucleus formed when the first outer space level is perfected. I think the four outer space levels are successive cytoplasmic areas in relation to this continuing nucleus. Because not until all four outer space levels have been completed do we again witness the formation of a trinity. It takes the appearance, the emergence of God the Ultimate to produce the second experiential trinity, made up of the Supreme Being, the Ultimate, and this mysterious, unrevealed consummator of universe destiny. Now, is this the end? Well, I don't think so. You see, there's still the Deity Absolute. We've come back now to the yolk of the egg. Could the Deity Absolute ever be experientialized? The answer is no. You'd have to exhaust infinity to do that. What's going to happen then? Are we at a deadlock? Are we at an impasse? The second experiential trinity has a function which suggests something larger than the master universe. What is this master universe? Is it an end? I submit that the master universe is the third nucleus, the final nucleus, and that it exists in relation to some outer cytoplasmic universe which is infinite. which has no end.
Well, there won't be any nuclear fission then.
Mm-hmm.
With the three.
No. It's a triple nucleus. I visualize this. At the beginning of all things, we had two existential deities and a power base for operations. They trinitized an equal being, the infinite spirit, and produced Havana. At the final master universe age, the age of the fourth outer space level, I can see harmony, a theme reappearing. Once again, we have two unique deities, experiential deities this time. Once again, we have a power base for operation, the perfected master universe. And I would suggest, and the papers will support this, that the Supreme Being and the Ultimate will in some unimaginable way trinitize God the Absolute and begin the invasion of the cosmos infinite. They will establish a beachhead on the shores of infinity. Now, God the Absolute, so trinitized, is sub-infinite, because neither the Supreme Being nor the Ultimate nor the combination of the two is an infinite deity. But how vast are the resources on which they draw. And remember, they can mobilize all of the experiential potential from the tennis ball, the bedroom, the city block, the cubic city, and the moon. This is vast. This is less than infinite, but nonetheless tremendous. What they can mobilize will not represent an unworthy effort. And God the Absolute, I think, is going to appear. And since he's sub-infinite, he can grow. And I think this is the final adventure, the post-ultimate adventure. And I think we'll be there, because the papers instruct us that the last dimension of human personality is competent to attempt a sub-infinite penetration of the absolute level of reality. We can get up onto the third floor, and we can grow and grow and grow. And the reason that we can't ever finish is because I drew this a little wrong. This building happens to be open to the skies. There's no roof on the third floor. We can go, and we are never going to hit the top. There is no roof on the third floor. Again, as I consider this, the first universe age had no beginning in time. It had an end in time. The last universe age will be the mirror image of the first. It will have a beginning in time. It will have no end in time. Now, there is a bobtail version of page 2.
Very good. Let's start.
Let's turn it off, bud. See, this starts out with a commercial. Well, so far, I've thought of around 62 questions for our exams.
What will it be when you give it?
Well, I don't know whether we'll have 50 in a unit or 100.
No.
Does 50 sound all right? 50 in each unit?
Mm-hmm.
There's so many good junior questions that you hit in the text. Well, let me ask you some questions. What kind of problems are you hitting in your reading that bother you, if anything. Why don't you lead out, Betty?
Let me think a moment, please. I can't give flash answers.
As we said last year, the whole objective of one of these seminars is to emerge with an ignorance that is more properly unified. We're never going to know very much about what these people are telling us, but we can get our ignorance well unified. And a unified ignorance is so much more comforting than chaotic ignorance.
I don't want to be the whole front, though. Well, actually, I think Bud gave me very good advice. He said to read the book as a novel.
Yes.
I have found out that of course, everything reverts back eventually to self, doesn't it?
Sure.
And well, I find that I've been quite cynical, and I'm having to overcome cynicism to get this book.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I'm not quite sure I do, but I didn't realize what a cynic I was, actually, until I began reading this. I read it rather slowly, and I'm afraid after I finish a paper, I go back and reread it. Bud suggests, and I think he's quite right, and Dorothy also, that I read it without going back and just keep going forward.
Well, a cynic is a disappointed idealist.
It's what, Bill?
A cynic is a disappointed idealist.
Oh,
yeah. And didn't Jesus win him over in Rome?
Mm-hmm.
There.
Well, the cynics meant something different in those days.
Yeah.
You see, a cynic is a person who has not only hoped too high, that's all right, but the idealist expects too high. And if you don't separate your hopes and your expectations, you foredoom yourself to disappointment. As it says in the Morantia Life, if you make fewer personal plans pertaining to other personalities, you will become father to fewer disappointments. That's a very great statement.
Yes, it is.
I put it in my own words and thinking by saying that I hope I'm a realist who has ideals. Because an idealist views life in serious distortion, so does a cynic. Serious distortion.
Uh-huh.
Both cynic and idealist view life with one eye, and they see life flat. Both cynic and idealist have unified their hopes and their expectations. The idealist has attempted to unify them on a high level, and the cynic has attempted to unify them on a very low level. And I believe they should be separated. In other words, I think we should hope high and expect low. The problem arises partly because things are not just real or not real. Things are not just actual or potential. We encounter a very troublesome gray area, which I would call the zone of becoming. Now let's take a good, for instance, let's take the Brotherhood of Man. Is this real? No, of course not. Of course not. I read a headline. What was that earth-shattering headline we saw at lunch, Bob? Somebody is not going to be somebody else's champagne girl anymore.
Oh, yes.
Now, I don't know any of the names, but I understand champagne. Somebody is no longer swinging with somebody else who is not digging that somebody or something like that. Well, at the same time, can you say that the Brotherhood of Man is not a reality? No, you can't say that either. It's in this confusional area. It's an ideal. It's not yet a down-to-earth working idea. It will be an idea someday. Shoot.
May I please interrupt? Would you define reality?
Yes, something that's actually here. In terms of potentiality, something which is not yet here. Today's living generation is an actuality here on Earth. The unborn generation of the immediate future is a pure potentiality. But it's a real potentiality because it's going to be here in another 20 years.
I want to say something, I'm not quite sure how to put it.
The Brotherhood of Man is sort of like a baby before it's born. It isn't here. The illustration's crude.
Aren't there other... Could you elaborate on this reality? I feel there's a...
Well, I'm talking about actuality and potentiality, both of which are embraced under the term reality. Here, we're actually here. No question about it, is there?
Well, there might be some...
I think I'm here. Right. But an unborn child, an unconceived child, is a pure potential. You follow me?
Yes.
The brotherhood of man won't classify either way. It is and it isn't here. And it's here in varying degrees and different hearts. Now, here's how I approach this problem. I have my hopes and my expectations better separated than they've ever been before. When I meet a new brother, I know he's a brother, and I hope that he feels this way. But I don't expect him to be any more than a so-and-so who will try and do me in. And this happens every now and then. And when I meet my percentage of SOBs, I'm not shattered, I'm not shook up. I don't expect anything more. I defend myself to the best of my ability. I won't let him destroy me. And I just chuckle and I say, well, the human race has only been out of the jungle a few thousand years. Civilization hasn't got to him yet. Maybe it won't, but there's hope for his kids and his grandchildren. I hope he's a nice guy. I don't expect him to be. As long as you hope and expect at the same level, you're in trouble. Because you're either going to become a Pollyanna, going through life saying, evil is not here, which makes you a Buddhist. Or else you're going to get to be a hard-boiled cynic and saying, they ain't nothing good. And I think life is a mix. I think both the idealist and the cynic have slipped into the ditch. One on one side of the road, one on the other. And the crown road is difficult to drive on. It takes a lot of steady steering because it's slippery. I've been in both ditches at one time or another, but I don't like to stay in the ditch. I want to drive down the road. And to me, if you look at life with high hopes and very realistic expectations, how good could it be and how loused up might it get? I think you get not visual confusion, I think you get depth perception. This is the range-finding principle. Our two eyes see things from a different angle of vision. The result is not confusion, the result is depth perception. I think you have greater insight into life. You get a better stereoscopic effect of evaluation. Each year I live, I grow to expect less of my fellow men, and I think I love them a little more. I expect less of the human race today than at any time in my short life, and I think I have more affection for them than I've ever had before. My expectations are lower than they've ever been, and my hopes are higher. And as you broaden the base of your vision, you get greater and greater depth perception. Are you with me?
Oh, yes, I certainly am. I think that's wonderful. I mean, as I told, but things like this make me, I don't know why they make me want to cry.
I understand. I understand.
Well, we have an infinite supply of Kleenex.
I'll tell you what this book means to me. If you'd like, and this may be worth taping, I gave a talk for the Oklahoma Society. It may be worth taping. I gave a talk for the Oklahoma Society, and this was an open meeting. It was in the church, which they were then in process of abandoning. And it was advertised in the newspaper, and so lots of people showed up. I said, I'd like to talk about this book and what it means to me, because this book has very deep religious significance. But in my personal experience, I cannot separate religion and philosophy. The two are inseparable. I can't philosophize without getting religious, and I can't deal with religion without becoming involved in philosophy. I said, this book helps me think straight. There are two basic approaches which men have tried in civilization. One is exemplified in the medieval Christian attitude, When the Black Death hit Florence, the devout Florentine bowed his head, clasped his hands together, and prayed, saying, as he buried his family, "The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord." The Hindu and the Buddhist also attempt a spiritistic approach to reality. They say it isn't real. The Buddhist says that this world is an illusion. It's Maya. And my favorite illustration is a real sweet story from the Tripitaka of Buddhism. There are three monks. I think I told you this story last year. They're out begging. And they've got their begging bowls and their saffron robes. And of course what they're begging for is not money, but rice. And there's a hare in each begging bowl. And of course a hare in your soup bowl is unpleasant. The youngest monk is a neophyte. He's very annoyed with the hare. This is a horrid thought. The older monk, the in-betweener, he's not annoyed by the hare because while he perceives the hare, he knows it's not real. The oldest monk is on the threshold of nirvana. He does not see the hare. That's one way of dealing with the material problems of life. You either say they're not real, or you bow your head and trust in the Lord. Now comes the Renaissance and the revival of Greek humanism, and the Florentine began to bestir himself. And he began to say, now there's something we can do about this. Eventually we wind up with sanitary practices. We begin to discover that this is a universe of law and order, and if we can learn about these laws, we do not have to be passive in relation to our environment. Humanism evolves. The non-religious, intellectual approach to life. Man's reason strikes off the shackles of limiting, inhibiting faith. And the book speaks of faith as something which limits, in contrast to belief which liberates. And he says, well, let's have at these problems. He finds out about sewage disposal. He eventually winds up with medicine. He eventually winds up with atomic energy. And he falls in love with this concept. He attempts to approach reality using mind instead of spirit. And believe me, he's successful. Our whole industrial civilization, this is right out of our problems of secularism at the end of the book, evolves by virtue of the fact that man's logical thinking attacks material reality. But there's something wrong with this approach too. Because in my lifetime, we have scientifically killed more people than have been killed in the Christian era. I have witnessed fear spread over all the world. For the first time, the people in the United States of America are thinking as though they lived in the Balkans. The enemy is only a few hours away. This is the way Bulgarians once thought about Serbians, and Montenegrins thought about Romanians, and they were all afraid of Russia and Austria-Hungary and Turkey. There's something wrong with this approach. I think there's something wrong with the spiritistic approach. I don't like the idea of just bowing my head and saying, "The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord," if we can keep people alive. These papers help me out of this impasse. These papers teach me that total reality exists in three different levels. And when I spell reality with an R, capital R, this is the biggest word I know. It's synonymous with infinity. This is everything that has been, is, or will be. These papers teach me, way over in the next to the last page, in this book, that reality falls into three general categories: thing, meaning, and value. And I deem this to be one of the most helpful concepts in all the papers. Write the word reality across the top of the page and then draw three columns under it. Now put it on the blackboard. Yes, I do. You do need protection. These headings could well cover the three divisions of energy, which is matter, mind, and spirit. These papers instruct me that when I'm working in the domain of things, the Renaissance Florentine attitude is right. I should use reason. I have no right to pray until I've exhausted human resources. They tell me when I'm over in the domain of value, I should use faith. Things never touch values. Matter never touches spirit. But both impinge on this fascinating intermediate zone. And here, in the domain of meanings, I may attempt to use logic. If I'm successful, if the human race is successful, then, as a result of this, we evolve science and religion and philosophy. If we can think clearly, then we can respond to the great challenge that's portrayed in these papers. Every religion portrays a challenge. Medieval Christianity, the challenge very largely was the fear of hell. Very little about the love of God. The Zoroastrian religion presents a challenge. It's terrifically, morally stimulating. It says, choose sides. There's Ahura Mazda and the forces of light, and there's Ahriman with the forces of darkness. And in the annals of time, they contend as equal contenders, even though lightness triumphs in eternity. Buddhism challenges you. Do you want to be separate from the oversoul of creation with all this illusion? Or by stripping yourself of these illusions, can you find unity with the oversoul of creation? The Urantia book presents a challenge. The Urantia book, at least three times, if not more, in the papers, makes this statement. On paradise, energy and spirit are coordinate. In Havona, they are unified. But in the evolutionary cosmos, energy matter is dominant, save in personality, where spirit, through the mediation of mind, is striving for the mastery. Let's see what that means. Mind can whip matter. The material universe is a mind-managed, mind-dominated physical creation, starting with the third source and center, and running right down through the force organizers, power directors, and so on. We can see that on the human level. The mind of man is slowly but certainly dominating this planet. When we set up a pipeline, what are we doing but building an artery in the planet? When we lay a telegraph line, what are we doing but laying a nerve on the planet? We're remaking this planet in our own image. Someday we'll control weather if we don't blow ourselves up first. We are slowly but certainly, through our science, dominating our physical environment. But we're attempting to do this without spirit. This is mind unidentified with spirit. This is the secular, humanistic approach to the domain of things. And the net result is that we breed fear. Why? Because we can't stop worshiping. And when we stop worshiping God, we keep on worshiping. Perhaps science. I have a friend who is deeply religious, and the name of his religion is science. You show him any mystery which science can't explain, and he answers, credo credimus. I believe, we believe, that science will explain this in the future. This is faith in this level. It's a dislocation of faith. When Neanderthals buried their dead, they buried stone axes with them because they knew they were going someplace better than where they'd been, and it would be a happy hunting ground, and this stone axe would come in handy. They believed. Man is incurably worshipful. When he stops worshiping God, he starts worshiping something temporal. And he probably ends up by worshiping the state, because the state is the greatest repository of power. Power worship becomes, power becomes the object of man's worship. When man worships the state, if he starts out a conservative, he ends up a fascist. And if he starts out a liberal, he ends up a communist. And as between a fascist and a communist, I can make no choice. This is why we have loused things up almost beyond recognition in this generation. I don't think, again to quote the Blue Book, you can run a free society without God any more than you could run the solar system without gravity. This book tells me how to approach reality sanely and at the same time worshipfully. This book tells me that when I'm working with the domain of things, I depend on mind to attack. And if we attack, we'll win. At the same time, this mind has got to become subordinated to spirit. Otherwise, the power of science begets fear, not trust. We have more fear in the world today than we've ever had in human history. With all of our prosperity. I sit in my office in Chicago and I look down Michigan Avenue, and I love this dirty city that I was born in. And I think of the 150 years that men have been building that city, and we now know it could be destroyed in 150 minutes, just laid flat. And this could happen. This could happen before I get back home. You know what I mean? Next week, this week. This book tells me how to be sane. This book challenges me, as it should challenge the whole human race. Can we put mind to work, whipping matter, and at the same time allying mind with spirit, so that this mind becomes socially fragrant, morally sound, and ethically balanced? And this we can do because we have the power of choice to subordinate mind to spirit. And when we do this, we are working with the grain of the universe, which is another way of saying we're working in accordance with God's will. This is the first thing I've ever encountered which makes sense to me on all levels, materially, intellectually, and spiritually. I've never found anything like it. Betty, that's what the book means to me in non-technical language. This is in the book. You'll find it over here. And it's the greatest philosophic concept in the book, I think. It's at the very next to the last page at the end of the book. I'm going, you know, I've always wondered who wrote this book, and it says on here.
Don't be impaled. I suspected.
Well, she may not have written the book, but she's sure written in this one. I think it's here. I'm sorry, I missed the page. It's 2094 instead of 2096. In paragraph 2, there are just three elements in universal reality: fact, idea, and relation. The religious consciousness identifies these realities as science, philosophy, and truth. Philosophy would be inclined to view these activities as reason, wisdom, and faith. Physical reality, intellectual reality, and spiritual reality. We are in the habit of designating these realities as thing, meaning, and value. And of course, those last three words are such wonderful words because they're so small that I can understand them.
You said just a few moments ago that faith and belief are not the same.
No. When they use them separately, they say faith limits and belief liberates the evolving soul. No, belief not the other way around. Belief limits and faith liberates. I reversed it, yes. Belief limits and faith liberates the evolving soul.
That makes more sense.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I had the right assembly, but the cart was before the horse.
Bill, with that in view, what do you think the road to world peace is?
The road to world peace, Bob? We're in a cul-de-sac.
How about the Ermia lecture? That's pretty.
Would you like me to read you the most awful thing in the book about the problem of the present? Page 2082. Without God, paragraph 3. Without God, without religion, scientific secularism can never coordinate its forces, harmonize its divergent and rivalrous interests, races, and nationalisms. This secularistic human society, which is us today, here and now, notwithstanding its unparalleled materialistic achievement, is slowly disintegrating. The chief cohesive force resisting this disintegration of antagonism is nationalism. And nationalism is the chief barrier to world peace. We're in trouble. The most vital thing in the world today is nationalism. And the most grievous threat to world peace is nationalism. We're in the proposition of Solomon in the temple. If we pull at the columns, sure, we'll pull the temple down, but we're going to die in the debris. This is the horns of a real dilemma.
It's like using whiskey to cure a cold. You either keep the cold or you become healthy.
That's right.
In the Ermia lectures, it says there will never be world peace until there's the world of sovereignty. That's a long ways off.
It is.
It means that we're going to have wars.
Well, let me ask you this. What force in the world today is pushing scientific progress the strongest? It's nationalism. It's rocketry and all that sort of thing.
This is a rather ominous bit here. Still more terrible destruction is yet to come. This book I felt up to this point
34.
Was
1934.
Oh,
Second World War
was in the future then. Oh, I see. Yeah, I couldn't think of it.
However, that might not stop with the Second World War.
No.
We've at least had one installment, and I hope we've had the full payment. Yes, Ruth?
That comment, that phrase of yours, the grain of the universe, sticks in my mind because it is illuminating. To me, the Arantia makes that very plain. What the grain of the universe is, the evolutionary system.
Sure.
Not only biologically, physically, of course, first, and then biologically, but morally and spiritually. And how we can go along with it instead of fighting.
Yes. Why work across the grain?
That's it. One can do it so much more intelligently. One understands what the grain of the universe is.
fundamental movement.
This thing looks so simple, but yet you stop and think of man's approach to reality, and he tends to go in either of the extreme columns, and he doesn't get them working together. This is not simple. This seems simple because it happens to be truth. A few times he's tried the middle column. That's the most futile of all. The Greek philosophers never got it off the ground. I mean, actually, how many people really were inspired by Socrates and Plato? They were annoyed by Socrates, I believe, as subsequent events prove. The common people never heard Plato. What influence did Pythagoras have of a lasting nature? The Stoic and the Epicurean schools didn't live. Only religions lived. And yet religions have always attempted to destroy science and to fight this because science quarrels properly with the superstitions of religion and improperly with the truths of religion.
Bill, why did the religions survive? The organization?
Yeah, they all got organized. Sure. Sure. That's what makes democracy work, too. It's organization of political spoilsmen who see to it that the machinery works when the citizens are indifferent. Pardon me if I sound cynical, but that I live in Chicago.
I love cynicism. I think that's why I was one or had one.
Bill, could it be, too, that applies to religion? I'm thinking of the Hindu religion, which in its idealistic echelon, it is very philosophic, but now among the people, it is full of pagan gods.
Oh, sure.
And compromised with the most primitive instincts of the human race.
Look at the people who believe in Hinduism.
I know.
They're mostly illiterate.
Yeah.
They can't philosophize.
No.
Therefore, they have to go to pagan gods.
Religion has to work on all levels. It has to work on the level of truth and love. It's got to work on mixed levels. It's got to be institutionalized. It's got to have symbols. There are people who require symbols. It's got to have ritual. There are people who love ritual and are inspired by it. And then it's got to get really alloyed with evolutionary religion. Now listen, I've seen Roman Catholicism in the backwoods of Nicaragua where Spanish isn't understood. You're dealing with Indian dialects. And I would submit that Roman Catholicism, in that grossly adulterated form, is still better than just plain animism. Although, believe me, they've got under pretty good control down there. They've got their old gods still.
Bill, is that statement that Bud made about Hinduism accurate?
Say it again.
I'm talking about the conglomerate of the citizen of India, which has so many millions of...
But the hierarchy has to be either.
Well, they can philosophize, but the majority can't.
Here, as between Kali worship at the bottom, and that's not really at the bottom, and the concept of Sankara's Advaita Vedanta at the top, the person worshiping Kali, the wife of Shiva, the destroyer, and trying to placate Kali, and you're involved in everything from sacrifice to temple prostitution.